The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here's the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. Great show tonight. A really good guest. I wish I could do it like Ed used to do it. I can't do it, but a really good guest tonight. If you're old enough to know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. I do have a couple of quick announcements. So, number one, Hotel Mars with Bachelor went down today. The guest was Dr. David Grinspoon on Venus and Mars and a couple of other topics. The problem is that Grinspoon called in on a Skype line, and Bachelor was unable to connect me into it. So Hotel Mars this week will be Bachelor in Grinspoon and will not include me. I will still archive the program whenever Bachelor gets it up on his website, and I don't know when that will be, but that's just a heads up. The next heads up is those of you that have been wondering when the 16 Psyche Hotel Mars show with Lindy from Arizona State was going to be archived. Well, Bachelor finally posted it a week late at 4 p.m. California time today, and that program is archived. It's from last week. It bears a Thursday, January 19th date. But that program is finally archived, so you can read a short description of it. The description is not mine. It comes from John Bachelor's website. Again, because I did not participate in the program, I was helping a friend who was in the hospital. And so those are a couple of heads-up notes. And then there's a third one. I'm resurrecting my interest in doing the book about, we're now looking at the first 16-plus years of the Space Show. So if any of you out there are or know of professional editors with references and track records, I would like you to share that information with me. I'd like to talk to them, see how they operate, what they can offer, because the book, even if I used a traditional publisher, would still require editing before it ever left my desk. So I would appreciate that help if anyone out there has any of those services. And of course, our guest tonight is a prolific editor, a prolific author. So if he uses editors, maybe I can twist his arm to share a couple of names. Okay, so this is the Tuesday Night Space Show, and a couple of real quick announcements. You can call us and talk to Rod Pyle, our guest, and that phone number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and I'll get you up on air as quickly as possible. I do hold your calls over the break if that's relevant, and we do answer the phone over the breaks as well. So again, 1-866-687-7223. You can use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and also you can post a comment on the Space Show blog for this show. That is on our homepage, thespaceshow.com. Go all the way over to the right side, upcoming shows. This is the first show listed, and open up that archive page and then just go to the bottom and post your comment like you would on the blog, and I will get it within a couple of seconds, and I can ask Rod that your question or read him your comment. So those are the ways you can reach us tonight. There is a detailed newsletter at our website, again, thespaceshow.com, and it's over on the right side. It's uploaded fresh Sunday after our Sunday program. It has all of the week's programming listed, plus it has the schedule of upcoming shows and we're making some pretty good progress in filling out first quarter 2017 schedule. And in fact, I may be compelled to open up second quarter 2017 in just a week or so. We'll see how it goes. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or very rapidly download the show. If you're in the mood or in the market for Space Show t-shirts, hats, coffee mugs, things of that nature, there is a menu in the upper left-hand corner, and look for the support menu, and there you will find our logo wear store with Cafe Press. And if you do visit it, we appreciate it, and thank you for your support that way. And if you have any questions, be sure to email me, and we'll get back to you on that. There's also a Listen Live menu on that upper left menu. So a lot of you ask, how can you listen to archive shows, or you've just discovered the Space Show and you want to know how you can listen to a live streaming broadcast. Just follow those instructions in Listen Live. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to respond to your email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. I cannot configure your computer to work with a media player. That's on you. But if you have a functioning media player and you know how to use it, I can probably help you if you have any questions vis-a-vis Listen Live. Of course, the most important button on the Space Show has to do with supporting the Space Show. So you'll see the Support the Space Show with PayPal. And remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with one, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do contribute to the Space Show. Your contributions allow us to keep this program going and to keep our content distributed for free. So we do appreciate it. Remember, as a 501c3, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, your gift is tax deductible. If you're paying taxes in California, since we're a California public benefit corporation, your gift is also tax deductible in the Golden State. If you have any questions, visit onegiantleapfoundation.org or email me again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do have sponsors, and you'll see their banner ads going across our website. So do read them from time to time. I know everybody's busy and you take stuff for granted and this and that and the other. But our sponsors play a really pivotal role in making sure that we are able to do the Space Show. And so check out what their messages are. And for the first half of tonight's show, we have two sponsors. And let me read you their short messages. So this is from the Space Finance Group. Since you're listening to the Space Show, you're obviously passionate about space. We are too. We're the Space Finance Group. We can help you get the funding you need to make your space idea happen. Members of our team have helped people raise over $1 million using Kickstarter and similar platforms. You've been to the space conferences. You know there's no shortage of ideas. What there's been a shortage of is seed capital. We can help you get the resources you need to get started. We're online at spacefinancegroup.com. That's all one word. And you can reach us at jay.whitner, W-I-T-T-N-E-R, at spacefinancegroup.com. If you want to talk about space, call your friends. If you're ready to make your idea happen, call us. And you think that's funny?
Yes, I think it's cute. They're good. I worked with them on a project. They're very good.
Do you know them? Do you know Jay?
Yeah.
And his friend?
Yeah, I know them very well.
Yeah. The Space Foundation is another sponsor. They have their 33rd Space Symposium coming up, and they say connect, engage, and get business done all in one place at the 33rd Space Symposium, April 3rd to the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Their website, spacesymposium.org. And if you're planning to go, you need to be making reservations now, because there could be 15,000 people there, and Colorado Springs is not that big. Plus, the Air Force Academy is there and always has something going on that takes up hotel space as well. So do check it out. I'm moderating a panel involving all of the NASA center directors. That should be fun. So I think it's going to be on the last day as well. So I will be there. And if you're going and you want to meet up, I suggest you email me and ask me for my cell phone number so that we can find a way to meet, because the odds of running into one another, given how many thousands of people are there, are probably not great. So we appreciate the Space Foundation being our sponsor, and I hope many of you make it to their event and hope we get to meet. And that brings me to our guest today, who is, you've heard me talking about him already, Rod Pyle, and he is a significant author of space books. In fact, we have three recent books of his that we're going to talk about tonight. So one of them is called Amazing Stories of the Space Age, and it's got a subtitle, True Tales of Nazis in Orbit, Soldiers on the Moon, Orphaned Martian Robots, and Other Fascinating Accounts from the Annals of Spaceflight. So, lest you think this is a golden book for space, this is a real book, and he's got real pictures in it and real information in it, and it's been a lot of fun reading and very informative. And I think you'll enjoy it, and if you acquire it, I know you will enjoy it. The other book we're talking about is called Mars Making Contact. It's got a foreword in it by Jim Green, who is NASA's Planetary Science Division Director. A really terrific, oversized book, lots and lots of amazing color pictures, probably many that you have never seen before relating to Mars. And then he has a third book called Blueprint for a Battlestar, Serious Scientific Explanations Behind Safe Sci-Fi's Greatest Invention. So we have a lot to cover tonight. And again, Rod's bio is up on the website. You can read about him, but we're going to talk to him. This is our most prolific author of the year so far. And welcome back to the show. How are you? And by the way, his website, pylebooks.com, pylebooks.com. They're all there, plus more. Rod, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. Most of it's true.
What part is not true?
I'm not saying.
So we don't want to put out
that's right.
false news on the space show. God forbid that we should put out false news. So we're going to start with amazing stories. So you do have a lot of amazing stories in here, and a lot of them are fun. And, you know, we've heard rumors about Nazis and flying saucers and bases on the moon, you know, for ever since we were children. What's real? Did you explore those bases on the moon or what?
You know, I didn't, and I just got an email earlier today that I'm booked on Coast to Coast next month, so I'm going to have to figure out where those Nazi bases were. However, I did see Iron Sky, which was kind of a wretched movie, but it did tell us all about how the Nazis did evacuate to the moon after World War II, but I don't think I'll be covering that. Now, this is, I'm sure you run across this stuff when you write about the space age and the time before it, from World War II to, you know, the launch of Sputnik. Or read much about that era, you run across these stories. And the whole book started actually, boy, probably 12 years ago as a show proposal when I was working at the History Channel called Secrets of Space. You got to put a little reverb on there to get the full effect. And we got close a number of times between History Channel and Discovery, but it never quite got made. So it sat for quite a while, and I thought, you know, I'm going to clean this up, make it more serious, and rewrite it as a book proposal, and finally Prometheus signed off on it, and that's how it got started. So that's kind of the origin of that subtitle, and we struggled with that a bit, but finally at the end of the day said, okay, well, that's really what we're talking about, so let's go ahead and use it.
What is true and not true about Nazis and the space program?
As far as I know, I mean, we all know the von Braun story, designing the V-2s. There is a great story, an extension of that, I think it was the A-8-89, if I remember correctly, which was going to be the piloted V-2, and that was kind of that would have been a real jaw clencher because you'd have to pilot it to within striking distance and bail out. But I wanted to cover something which I found a little more compelling, which was Eugen Sanger's Silverbird, the rocket bomber that he was designing in the late 30s and trying to convince Hitler to build in the early 40s. And as far as I know, that's the only thing other than the V-2 that really got close. There were other discussions, but those are the two that got close. Sanger got far enough along to do design studies and some modeling and some wind tunnel testing and small mock-ups, but that's about as far as it went, because even Hitler wasn't crazy enough to believe that they could basically build a space shuttle in 1942.
Is this the Sanger that went on to England and had the aviation company and was designing space tourism vehicles and stuff?
I think it was their inspiration. Are you talking about the actual gentleman?
Yeah, the actual person.
Yeah. Boy, you know, I don't remember.
I don't know if it's the same one or not. So
yeah, I mean, he was not a young man even during the war, but he came up with plans that were as advanced as they could be for the time. But when you actually read the translation of it, which the Army did in the early 50s, it's some of his assumptions are pretty remarkable. I mean, he had a thrust range on his single stage to suborbit engine on the back of the rocket plane anywhere from, I think, something like 40,000 pounds to almost 120 or 200,000 pounds. So I don't know what he's planning to use for fuel. I don't know how he's going to extend those tanks enough. He had to be able to carry an 8,000 to 10,000 pound payload, because he had assured them that he could carry an 8,000 pound bomb to New York and then glide to Japanese held territory in the Pacific Ocean. So he had some pretty big claims. And of course, as people smarter than me have pointed out, you know, reentry in that thing, even though it's suborbital, would have been well beyond what probably could have been done at the time with the metallurgy they had. So, but it was an inspired design, and parts of the work he did made their way into the space shuttle and certainly into the dinosaur project of the Air Force, DYNA-S.
Right.
OAR, not the other one. It was brilliant for what he was trying to do. It was probably just not achievable within the time span and the amount of resources they had to aim at it.
Well, he was trying to do an SSTO, which we still can't do.
Yeah, although, you know, his launch technology was a little less conventional. It was that thing we used to see in movies like When Worlds Collide with the inclined rail system, and he had a pusher caboose. It was actually kind of an ingenious design. He had a very streamlined-looking pusher caboose that was going to get the rocket up to speed, and then it would fire its own engines as it neared the end of the incline and take off, and they'd put brakes on the caboose and then roll it back for the next launch. And, of course, like the shuttle program, when it was being worked up and sold to Congress in the 70s, he had this incredible flight rate, and, yeah, we'll launch the Azores. It'll be no problem, and we'll have this launch rate of multiples per day, and we'll obliterate New York with our 8,000-pound bombs or our atomic weapons if we can have them, and then we'll either land in Japanese-held territory, or if we can't quite make it, the pilot can bail out and he'll be captured, but it's a small price to pay for the glory of building the America bomber. And this is one of four different designs for the so-called America bomber with a K, but the other ones were more traditional bomber-type aircraft.
I've read the book, and I wasn't familiar about having soldiers on the moon. Tell us about that one. That was new to me.
That's probably the most fun of the stories. In the 50s, we had, as you know, a lot of paranoia. It was the height of the Cold War, moving into the 60s. And we had nuclear weapons, and because of a lot of very effective espionage and some of their own research, the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons by the late 40s, early 50s. So there was an incredible amount of paranoia about the high ground. So, you know, if the Russians get into orbit, are they with heavy rockets, are they going to be able to drop atomic weapons on our heads? And this is very scary, and we don't like that idea. So the idea was, let's seize the high ground before they have a chance to do so. So there was talk about orbital stations. Von Braun famously designed his inflatable wheel in the early 50s, which was shown in the Collier's articles that he did. That was supposed to be Army staff, but of course he was working for the Army, so everything he did at that point was going to be Army. So this was Project Horizon, and this was delivered to Eisenhower in 59, so after NASA had already been formed and von Braun had left the Army. And it was a plan to build a base on the moon using Saturn I and Saturn II rockets, and you were going to need a lot of them. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of launches. I think it was 146 launches with 16 rockets in reserve. And they were going to leave from Christmas Island because it was close to the equator, so that would be their point of departure. And, of course, they considered Canaveral, but the Air Force was in charge of that, and the Army didn't like that, I suppose. So it made sense to go to Christmas Island. They had looked at various locations where they could launch from. And they were going to send up multiple launches. They'd have a reconnaissance team go up in a direct descent lander, which was probably 4 to 5 times the size of the lunar module that they used in Apollo. And that was going to land on the moon, deliver 2 guys that would reconnoiter for 90 days to find a good place to put the base. And then they'd launch cargo containers and crew habs, which were, I think, 8 or 10 by 20 feet each, and a second crew of 9 men in multiple launches to arrive at the moon. And they were going to assemble all, dig trenches with explosives and construction equipment and assemble all the stuff and connect airtight fittings and build out the insides and cover it with lunar regolith and all this stuff in 15 to 30 days. After all, how hard can it be? So that was the big plan. It would ultimately be staffed by 12, maybe up to 20 people, up and running by 1965 and full operation by 66. And it was only going to cost about $9 billion.
We can't even do any of this stuff today. What were these people smoking back then? I guess they were called reefers back then, right?
Well, I think there was a lot of suppositions being made. I mean, they were still basically operating, as you know, off the kind of slide rule and the sweaty palms kind of work that von Braun had been doing ever since the Mars project. So it was the best calculations they could come up with. And, of course, you have to underbid these things in the hopes that the government will sign off. As far as I've been able to find, Eisenhower never took it seriously across his desk. And he said, yeah, right, I got a civilian space agency, move on. And that was kind of the last gasp of the Army. They did do a weapons study for space and lunar weapons in the mid-60s, but that was just something that came out of Rock Island Arsenal, and I don't think that was ever really presented seriously to anybody in the government.
Where was Rock Island Arsenal?
That is in Rock Island. It's in the East Coast. I forget which state it's in. It's the primary production plant for most Army weapons. Everything from sidearms to long arms to howitzers and mortars have been made there over the years, and it's been around since at least the early 18th century. And it was their primary weapons facility. So there was a gentleman there who penned a study called the Meanderings of a Weapons-Oriented Mind in a Lunar Vacuum or something like that. So it's not really clear if he's talking about the weapons or his mind in the lunar vacuum, but this was actually published in 1965 for limited distribution, obviously. It was top secret. And he had, I think, probably 8 to 10 different weapons designs, all handheld sidearms that would fire pellets and flechettes, and darts, and all kinds of other, some self-propelled, like the gyrojet, little rocket-powered bullets. And the idea was they'd be low recoil and operate well in a vacuum, and they were worried about like metals fusing in a vacuum if you use a traditional weapon. And there was also some concern with long arms about if you aimed the bullet at the exact right trajectory, would it possibly circle the moon and come back and hit you in the back, which nobody wanted. So these were some of the ideas behind these weapons they were designing. And I might add, for Project Horizon, just jumping back to that for a minute, they did have weapon systems that were intended for lunar use because, of course, if we had a base on the moon, it wouldn't be long before the Reds had a base on the moon, and they would certainly send their soldiers bounding Buzz Aldrin style across the surface at us with their weapons. So the two that they actually did develop to some extent were the lunar Claymore mine, which was a lot like the terrestrial Claymore mine that we all know. 700 steel pellets that would be propelled out at great speed by plastic explosive and shred the bad guy's spacesuits. But my favorite was the Davy Crockett nuclear mortar, which looks a lot like a bazooka on a tripod, actually, that had a sub-kiloton yield warhead. And they actually tested these things, and they did deploy them to Europe. And it was a shoulder-mounted, smoothbore bazooka sort of weapon that would fire this nuclear warhead. And if you fired it at just the right trajectory, they had accuracy problems. You could duck fast enough to avoid being cooked by it, but it was by no means guaranteed because it only went about 2.5 miles.
And these were tested to work on the moon?
Well, they were tested on Earth. The assumption was they weren't great on the moon because they'd probably go further because there's no air resistance, but they were never tested in the vacuum.
Now, these were classified programs?
Although I don't know when they declassified the Crockett because, like I said, it was deployed, so I don't remember what the date of the declassification on that was, but there's film on YouTube of the thing being tested, so you see it's fired remotely, and then they cut away to some bleachers filled with older guys with skinny ties and sunglasses on. It's just a tremendous explosion, and they worked. Thank God they were never used in anger.
What's your favorite story in this book? Because you have, I think, 22 chapters of stories.
Yeah, I think probably Project Horizon is pretty close to the top just because it's so outrageous and kind of over the top. I love the Mars Project. That was von Braun's plan, which he wrote up in the late 40s when he was killing time. I think he was still at White Sands then, and there wasn't a whole lot going on except testing and retesting V-2s. And he had actually started that as a novel called Mars, A Technical Tale. That was so awful, even when they were publishing lots of books, but like back then, no publisher would touch it. And I finally located a copy, and I see why. It's pretty sappy. So he took the technical appendix from that and actually published that, augmented it a bit, and published that as the Mars Project in 52, 53 in German and then later in English. And this was his grand plan to get to Mars with rockets using much less powerful fuels than we use now. He was going to have shuttles that would take all the heavy stuff they needed up to orbit to assemble this armada of 10 ships, I think 3 crew and 7 cargo. And it was going to take 950 launches of these things, and they were going to depart from, instead of Christmas Island, they moved it to Johnston Atoll, which is this god-awful little spit about the size of an aircraft carrier of coral out in the Central Pacific. I was there once, and I had no interest in going back. And that was going to be a logistical nightmare. And then when these things were assembled, they'd depart Earth orbit and head to Mars en masse as an armada, which is what he called it. And they would land the first one on the North Martian pole on skis because they wouldn't have a runway and they weren't sure if Mars was smooth or not because, of course, at this point, this being the early 50s, nobody really knew what Mars was all about. For all we knew, there were canals there. We hadn't seen it close up yet. So they land on skis, and then the small skeleton crew in that landing boat would build a couple of tractors, and they would sledge their way all the way down to the equator, where they would build runways for the rest of the landing ships to come down and do their expedition, and then after the requisite number of months, pack up, come home. Now, coming home is interesting because these are horizontal landers, so you had to take the wings off and then pivot them on this big kind of erected crane system into a vertical position to be able to take off and come back home. And because, of course, at that point, nobody used the term in situ resources, at least not seriously, they're going to have to carry all the fuel for both ways of the trip. So it would have been quite an endeavor.
But, you know, you wonder the state of aerospace engineering and science and, you know, planetary knowledge, even lunar knowledge, back then, because if they were serious about these kinds of projects, but they had our modern-day expertise, their plans for hardware would have probably been vastly different.
Yeah, and at that point, I think they were off by a factor of 5 or 10 on their estimations of the atmospheric pressure on Mars. So his gliders would have, you know, gone straight in and augured in and ended up spread out across couple dozen miles of Martian surface because the wings would never have been big enough to carry that weight. So there are a lot of things they didn't know. And, of course, you know, being in space, as we're finding, is a lot harder than we thought. All the recent research coming out about the effects on the cardiovascular system of radiation and the effects on neurons in the brain from radiation and bone mass loss and all that kind of stuff. There's a little discussion of that in the Mars Project, but obviously not very much because it just wasn't something they knew about. So that duration of a journey in that generation of spacecraft, they would have at least been warm, of course, because they'd be using vacuum tubes for all their electronics, and that's one plus.
What are the turtle knots?
Turtle knots was Zond 5, which was a Soviet project in the mid to late 60s to send a stripped-down Soyuz around the moon. They were not admitting that they were in a moon race with us, but they were in a moon race with us, as we found out later. And so the Zond was this kind of generic classifier for their experimental spacecraft. They used them for a lot of different things, but in this case they used them for the Soyuz. So they sent two missions to the moon. One of them actually went in the opposite direction to the moon and just did a big loop and then came back, and the other one did actually loop the moon. They did the first one that way because they didn't want to have to worry about the gravitational dynamics of the moon. But the other one, Zond 5, went around the moon and came back. And the reason I called the turtle knots is because they had living organisms in it, because they wanted to test them in the radiation environment outside the Earth's magnetic belt. So they had fruit flies, a couple of snapping turtles, a bunch of bacteria, and I think some seed stock. And everybody came back in good shape. Unfortunately, the first one, Zond 4, came back too steep and did not make a successful landing. Zond 5 was more successful, but it's arguable whether cosmonauts would have survived either one, so it's probably good they didn't try. So this was their attempt to loop the moon and try and steal Apollo's thunder before Apollo 8 had a chance to actually orbit.
But they didn't steal that thunder, did they?
They did not, and it would have been interesting. You know, you hear lots of talk of people bemoaning, oh, why can't we have the, but probably not in your show, because I think most people know better, but in general publications, there's a sentiment of, why can't we have another Apollo moment? Because the nation was united and they were behind it and everybody wanted the same thing. And within a couple of years of Kennedy's announcement, people were not enchanted with that anymore. More than half the population thought it was too much money. They wanted us out of Vietnam. They wanted the Apollo project either to be shut down or curtailed. And there weren't really spikes until Apollo 8, spikes in popularity until Apollo 8 orbited the moon. And as you know, it waned very quickly as the landings progressed. And by the time Apollo 14 came along, I remember very clearly watching the moonwalks while I was playing hooky from school. And they were already starting to cut away to General Hospital and Days of Our Lives, which even that tender young age, I thought, this is just shameful. But it kind of shows you the level of interest that an awful large portion of the population had. So, you know, I think that that myth of this vast support of the Apollo program affects a little more thinking than it should.
This disappeared, but we're so united now that I just look forward to getting all this stuff done that we couldn't do before. But I think our unity today will really propel us forward.
On the private side or the public side?
As a country, our unity as a country.
Hmm. Well, I guess the question is, what are we going to do?
And so you're taking me seriously. I was.
Well, I'm having a moment here, David. I'm hoping you didn't mean that.
No, I mean, sarcastic.
The question is, and I'm sure you've talked about it on the show, what are we going to do?
Okay, well,
I interviewed a number of people for this book project I'm working on now in NASA and in the private sector and in aerospace. And where appropriate, I was always asked, what of SLS and Orion? And as you know, people aren't directly involved with it. For the most part, they give you that big gladiator's thumb down, you know.
It depends on who you talk to. So, you know, it depends on who you talk to. I could give you 20 people off the top of my head, and they would absolutely know exactly what we should do. And none of the 20 would probably be saying the same thing, although there would be some similarities in what they say. And then you either have a love affair with SLS and Orion, or you really despise it. So it depends on who you talk to. And I think that whatever policy comes out for NASA and for our national space policy and what we're supposed to be doing, it'll, you know, piss off half the people and a third of the people will be glorious, and a third of the people won't even know what we're talking about. So there's nobody, I don't think, that you could interview. There's no group of people that speaks for the industry. So if you really wanted to know what we should do, all you could do is find out what groups want to do or what well-known, famous individuals want to do. But I don't know how old you are, Rod, but I did go through the Apollo era, and we did speak with unity, not to be sarcastic now. We wanted to go to the moon. We wanted to beat the Soviet Union there. We wanted to stay at the moon. We were disillusioned when they canceled the last lunar flights. You know, that wasn't at all what we thought was going to happen. And
when you say we, you're talking about...
collectively, the society at the time. And I was in, I guess, junior high. And, you know, my views were the views of the whole school. I mean, and I don't think we were unusual from any place around the country. And people, you know, would come over to my parents' house and they'd be talking about the moon program and they wanted to go. And we only had three TV networks at the time, all in black and white. And, you know, we were glued to Jules Bergman and, you know, Cronkite and, you know, the group on NBC. And they'd have all these models of the rockets and everything, and they'd be teaching us everything. And we'd talk about it in school. And we felt that we were, as a nation, unified. Most of us felt that we were behind the Soviet Union in math and science. And I know students and teachers and parents took that really seriously. So students did, you know, take math and science classes and buckled down for that. They did not want to be behind. I think fear was a big motivator for that, because we were still doing duck and cover drills at the time. But there's no way this country could, even if it wanted to, go back into that era. It's not a possibility.
I think I'd say two things about that. One is, although that was my experience too, I was in elementary school at the time, but I was just looking at, it was either a Pew survey from the time or one of the other groups, that it was much less than, or a notable percentage less than half the population by the mid-1960s.
It started to fall apart, yeah.
That was supporting this. The media, however, of course, with three to four networks and a handful of radio networks, you've got incredible control. I mean, who could ever watch Jules Bergman or Walter Cronkite talk about the space program and not be in love with it if you were followers of those guys? But in the surveys, at least, there seemed to be a lot less dedication to it. But, I mean, I had the same experience. So we talked about it at school. It was on television. They talked about the moonshot all the time, and we followed the developmental flights. And then, of course, that terrible tragedy with Apollo 1 that shook everybody up. But to think back now that there was a point in the Apollo lunar landing profile where these things were flying every 8 to 10 weeks is just absolutely mind-boggling. And I was very surprised. You peel back the layers of history in these things, and of course it's often difficult to find sources that agree on anything, even when they're written down from the time, primary references. But I was very surprised. I was reading Chris Kraft's autobiography where he said, you know, I was not dismayed by the cancellation of Apollos 18, 19, and 20. And in fact, I forget exactly how he phrased it, but he said in some ways he was in favor of it because he felt that they had been out on the bleeding edge for so long that it was inevitable that they'd lose a crew. And he was somewhat comforted by that, which, you know, you understand when you think about the technology of the time. And his contention was that they were extremely lucky. They were good, but they were also lucky.
Right, especially for the Saturn V. They didn't think they could keep it going with a perfect record. But another thing that happened is that the space program started to get competition with the unrest in the country over Vietnam. And
right.
And that was eventually all-consuming. And I know that I had family in Vietnam. And, you know, they used to communicate home with us through Mars talks. I don't know if you know. You probably know what a Mars conversation was. But they would communicate with shortwave and amateur radio, and those were the Mars calls that they would make back to family members, and it would be over and out, you know, that kind of crap.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other way they do it is they could send 3-minute voice tapes, literally reel. So it'd be reel to reel, these little 3-minute tapes back and forth.
Yeah, I remember those.
From my relatives that were over there, and I had quite a few of them, and I was Navy in San Diego, but never went in country, but they were really pissed at the attention that the Apollo 13 astronauts got when they got in trouble, you know, with people praying for them all over the world and everything else, because they felt that they were being killed and mutilated and ruined every single day, and their friends were, and nobody gave a crap about them. And then here you got three astronauts, and they just felt, you know, what a disproportionate global bit of prayer and attention. Where are we, the forgotten soldiers fighting for freedom, supposedly? And they were pretty universally really upset with the disproportionate focus on space and getting the astronauts back over what they were having to endure in Vietnam at the time. And I think Vietnam actually consumed the country and probably played a big role in the demise of the space program.
That's an interesting point, and one certainly understands why they would feel that way. And you have to wonder if there was a bit of pressure on the media to look more at the space program and less the war, because the war was certainly unpopular. And, of course, there's the glamour of exploration. You said earlier you don't see the Apollo-type era coming back, and there's certainly lots of people that would be glad if it didn't, because they don't like the whole flags and footprints, you know, closed-end program idea, and I certainly understand that. But I think it was also a perfect storm in the 60s. I mean, you had Kennedy making this proclamation, the perfect time. I mean, we only had 15 minutes in space at that particular moment when he right. made the first speech, but it was a good timing in terms of the technological profile that the U.S. was able to bring to bear quickly. We had this enemy in the Soviet Union that we wanted the best, and as I'm sure you know, that was the one thing his science advisors said, you know, space station, they're going to do it first. Getting around the moon, they're probably going to do it first. They got bigger rockets. Landing, coming home, that's technically demanding. Maybe we can do that first. So there was that part, and then, of course, Kennedy's assassinated. And I had a bit of a back and forth with somebody, not argumentative at all, just us kind of each testing our knowledge, and his on in the general topic was a little better than mine. But talking about, you know, my contention is that I think Kennedy's assassination kind of made this a bit of a political hot potato. And if you're going to try, you know, Walter Mondale comes along saying, yeah, we're spending too much money on space. We need to feed the poor and build bridges. And I think there was some pressure brought to bear about you're not going to take away this martyred Democrat space program, because we're just not going to do that. So I think a lot of things came together, but particularly this exotic, terrifying, death-dealing enemy in the Soviet Union. And you hear people talking about China assuming that role now, but I just don't see it. It's not the same kind of relationship, and I think the business aspect of our relationship with China is probably the biggest motivator for peace we've got.
Going back to your book, because I want to talk about some other books too. Sure. I also found your chapter Lunex. So I wasn't familiar with the program name Lunex, LUNEX, but this was also going on at the same time as we were developing NASA and the civilian space program. But here you had the Air Force coming in with their own program to do things in space. So you got the Army, you've got the beginnings of NASA, because I think that was 1959, right? You've got all of this, and you've got competition from different divisions within the government, all wanting attention and budgets and everything else.
Yeah, Lunex was an interesting one. It was not as ambitious as Project Horizon. It wasn't quite as wacky, if I can use that word. It was started in 1958. So you had all three major services saying, we should be doing space before NASA got the job. So you had the Army saying, well, we're responsible for capturing the high ground, so we should do space. And you got the Navy saying, hey, we build submarines. That's kind of like a spaceship. We should do space. It's a bit of a stretch, and we saw what happened with Project Vanguard, so that might not have been the best decision. And then you had the Air Force saying, hello, we fly airplanes. You know, we use control sticks. We use control surfaces in the air. We know how to do this. We'll do space. So Lunex came along, and the idea was to have also a base on the moon. The size of Horizon are a little bit bigger by 1968, about the same price, but they were going to use orbital rendezvous maneuvers instead of this direct descent system, so it would have required a bit less lifting power. And the Lunex vehicle was a lifting body kind of reminiscent of what a Dream Chaser looks like, except larger, which would have had very tightly packed crews of multiple airmen inside of it, and then, of course, a booster. So, you know, all these things are competing, of course, with the idea of Apollo, which was a little more traditional in its design in a lot of ways, and we're horribly under budgeted. The Air Force is claiming this would be $7.5 billion, and they'll have their base and their guys in it and be doing resupply runs, and, of course, coming back and forth at lunar speeds, mind you, with this lifting body design, which was something that was nowhere near tested. So it was finally canceled for the usual reasons.
You have a caller on hold. Do you want to try it?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
My name is Rich. I'm in Grants Pass, Oregon.
Hi, Rich. Nice to hear from you. Thank you.
Hi, Rich.
For calling.
Nice city.
Yes, I just I read a lot of the articles by Dwayne Day.
Yeah.
Talks about the
great writer.
Of the, and anyway, I'm torn between going back to the moon and going to Mars, and I guess I don't really have a question. I just wanted to make a comment about that. It seems like we don't know which direction to go or what decisions to make. So anyway, that's just my comment.
Hey Rich, I want to
first time caller.
Rich, I want to point you to something, and I'm not telling you I advocate this position, but it's an interesting position, and you may want to hear it. So on Sunday, I did a program about Mars spacesuits with Dr. Larry Kuznets, who's been involved in Martian spacesuit stuff and was an Apollo flight controller. And he goes way back, and he's now teaching this interactive class at Berkeley, over in Berkeley, California, UC California, on Mars spacesuits. But toward the end of the show, he got a question from a listener asking him what he thought about going to the moon as a stepping stone for going to Mars. So most of the people who respond to this say, yeah, it'd be good training ground, you know, all of that, and but we don't need it. If you're a Mars advocate, they say, you know, we don't need it, but yeah, probably, you know, as long as you don't get stuck there, it probably would be okay. Well, Larry went off on a pistol of a handle here, and he said that, and he had been making the case all during the show about the unique characteristics of Mars and why a Mars spacesuit would be so dramatically different with different requirements than any kind of spacesuit we have ever developed or used in the history of the space program, including Apollo, including orbital suits, everything, you name it. And I don't want to go into all of the requirements and the characteristics because that's on his show and not Rod's show. But he said that there is absolutely no reason to be going to the moon to do anything for Mars, and the cost, if you want to go build a fuel depot on the moon, if you want to do manufacturing on the moon thinking that you're going to use it as a jumping off point for Mars, the cost is in such a high level of billions that you would never get to Mars, and that the requirements for life support and for a spacesuit and for being able to do things on Mars are so radically different than on the moon, because Mars has 38% gravity and the moon has 1/6, plus other issues that he talked about on the show. He finally said, in the bottom line is, if you go to the moon to go to the Mars, you may never get to Mars, and at the very least, it would delay getting to Mars by 50 years. So if this is a topic of interest to you and to other listeners, I would urge you to listen to the Larry Kuznets show. So he made these comments in about the last 15 minutes of the program, maybe the last 20 minutes of the program. But the entire program is about why Mars is so different and has so many requirements and characteristics that are very special that the moon and orbital space do not have and are not even close to being similar with. So I only point that out to you because you brought up the moon versus Mars argument. Larry's very compelling, you know, if I talk to advocates of the moon, you know, they'll dispel that and they'll dismiss him. So I don't know the answer to it, you know, Rich. I don't know which is better. I do want to return to the moon. I think in a perfect world, and if we were perfectly funded for space, we could do both. The Sophie's Choice of space, which we're forced into because of our crazy politicians and our budgeting process, is choose one or the other. And I think that sucks. But that's the reality on the ground, choose one or the other.
Well, and David, you and I are both at the same conference a few months ago where NASA was laying out the big plan, which, of course, could change at any moment. And it seemed to me that the question there was not Moon or Mars, but it was more about Moon landing or Mars. There was plenty of talk, of course, primarily by the major contractors, aerospace contractors, about, you know, Earth orbit, okay, we're leaving that. We're going to go do work in cislunar. That's our proving ground and so forth. And Gerstenmaier was talking about that at some length. And then go to Mars when we're sure we're ready, and a little less talk about lunar resources because that's a private sector issue. But it felt like really, although I understand what you're saying and your other guest's point, that there an awful lot of the consternations about, you know, do we try and do this landing and outpost there or just keep going because they're both expensive, but landing there and setting up shop and doing our 21st century version of Project Horizon or LUNEX is very expensive, and then do we get hung up on getting to Mars or not? And of course, the other end, and, you know, I'm a layman. I'm not an engineer. I'm a writer. So take this point of view for what it's worth. But, of course, the other end of the discussion is, you know, that's the push side. What's the pull side? You know, we have some ideas about what we can get out of the moon and in terms of resources and how we can use them, and it's all in this system that's fairly close to Earth in terms of energy and distance and everything else. When you're talking about Mars, and I thought it was impressive, but at Guadalajara, when Elon Musk was talking, he didn't even try and close that business case. He just basically said, I want to go. I think it's important. I think it's important for the fate of humanity. And I want to do it. I don't want to do it myself. I want somebody else to do it first, and then I'll go when they prove it's safe, which I kind of liked.
Well,
but he didn't even try and close that case.
All I can say is, for those of you that want to hear a different perspective on this, that we don't hear as often on the space show as we hear the cislunar and moon case, listen to the Larry Kuznets show from this past Sunday, and I think it's about an hour and 40 minutes long, something like that. And you'll hear him make a different case at the end of the show, but you need to hear all of what he says about Mars and why you need this kind of spacesuit or that and the environment on Mars and this and that in order to get to where he is when he says you go to Mars. Going to the moon doesn't have anything to do with going to Mars. So
I'm definitely going to listen to that, but just curious, was a big part of what he was talking about is the soil and the surface conditions on Mars regarding the suit?
Well, part of what he was talking about is that the weight of a spacesuit is 350 pounds on Earth. Okay, and on the moon it's 1/6 of that. On Mars it's almost 40% of that. So you can't function on Mars wearing that much weight on your back. So that's one thing. The other thing is he talked about the temperature extremes. And so a Mars spacesuit can be very, really warm depending on where you are, and then it can be very, very cold. So they talk about layering a spacesuit. Well, how do you layer a spacesuit? And he talked about cooling and the requirements for cooling and then the requirements for joints. And it just goes on and on and on. And those requirements are not the same for an orbiting spacewalk, and they're not the same for anything close to what we do on the moon. So he does talk some about the soil, but he talks about the entire complete comprehensive Martian environment and gravity field, as well as things like radiation and stuff. It's very, very interesting. And as I said, it's not what we normally hear on the space show. And Larry does have the bona fides to talk about Mars spacesuits. He's been involved with it for 40 years.
Right.
So, and gotten nowhere with it because of our policy. But maybe his project now will get something to do it. So I just, for those of you that want to hear something different, it's again from this past Sunday. And I would urge you to listen to the show. And, Rich, maybe that'll shed some light on the Moon-Mars argument for you. I don't know.
No, I'll listen to it, and I certainly appreciate appreciate that. I love your programs, and
thank you very much.
The debate. Doug Plata and Dr. Zubrin, all of your guests are just great.
I've got an email to read from Doug Plata. You want to stay on and hear it?
Yeah, just briefly, sure.
Rod, I'm going to ask this to you, although I guess it's for you. I know it's not specific to you, but since you're the guest of honor, you can deal with Dr. Doug in Southern California. Let's say we find that China is planning on not only ending crew to the moon like we did decades ago, but they indicate that their objective is to do better by establishing humanity's first permanent off-Earth foothold. What's more, let's say that we estimate that it would take much more for them to drive around the poles, surveying, prospecting, and improving the polar areas by creating dustless roads. Don't you think that some congressmen would start to get nervous about them taking the lead and excluding us from their operating areas, meaning the lunar pole? What do you think? And so if I were answering that question, I would start with the assumptions that Doug was making and tell him what I think about that. But you're the guest of honor, and this is for you.
Okay, I get to go first. The part of that really caught my attention was beyond the general question was Congress. So I've long felt that Congress is going to dither around and twiddle their thumbs and twist on this whole thing. Constellation's going to continue to grind forward at great expense, with a question mark for a mission and a huge price tag. The private guys are going to do their thing. Somewhere in the interim, China is going to possibly have this burst of activity and do a Hail Mary to the moon of one kind or another, maybe a flyby, maybe a landing. It doesn't really matter in this particular part of the discussion. But I want to be on the floor of Congress when those guys or a couple of senators turn to each other and say, how could you let this happen? And we know who let it happen, and we know to a large extent why it happened. That's why we have space settlement conferences and things like this to talk about this over and over and try and scratch our heads and figure out how do we motivate these people to make cohesive decisions, some kind of consensus, so we can move forward, because we have a different system than China. They have to make decisions 5 to 10 years in advance and generally stick with it. It's more complicated than that. They don't have the kind of private sector activity that we do, and they also have a military thumb somewhat on the back of their projects, which does make a difference. But they do get to decide and just stay on a course and get things done. And one wishes we could have a little more of that here, which is, I think, what you were talking about earlier about the Apollo program, at least for part of it. But then we also got to work out all these property and property rights issues and so forth, and that's going to be, I suspect, a bigger, uglier process than a lot of us would like.
Rich, do you want to comment on what Doug said?
I think that it is an important issue. I don't feel personally that China on the moon is that big of a threat, or it will concern too many people. It could motivate some people to get our space program going. I keep thinking of Moon Express and the private the Google Lunar X Prize, and but I don't see the Chinese as, I think we can cooperate with them, and I always had a high regard for their ancient culture and their ability to get along with the rest of the world. I mean, they're a communist system, but I think we can work with them in the future. I mean, we had the Apollo Soyuz in 1975 during, the height of the Cold War. So I'm not too concerned about the Chinese taking over the moon and putting up a no trespassing sign.
I think that's a good point that you make. I've been to China twice in the last couple of years, and I'm, again, no expert, but I've spent a lot of time in the culture and with the culture. And I think there's a general sense that, of course, there's the government, but, it's communism in quotes at this point, business rules. I mean, it makes Donald Trump look like a half a businessman sometimes. And I think if nothing else, if you kind of ignore the South China Sea issues we're going through right now, they're awfully pragmatic. If it's good business to coexist on the moon, I suspect they're going to be willing to coexist, because who wants to get into a shooting war up there over the water at the North Pole, because you can go to the South Pole. So I may, this may be a bit Pollyanna-ish on my part, but I'd like to think that we could coexist, and they're not going to go over and kick over all the flags and the old Apollo landing sites and so forth just because they're there. And that it's not a foot race. I don't know if cooperation's on the table. I don't hear from very many people a lot of hope about overcoming ITAR issues anytime soon. But we're in uncharted waters here, so who knows? The next 48 years are going to be very interesting.
Doug wanted to know if our congressman, so more so than what you guys think, if our congressman would start to get nervous about his scenario that he laid out, and would they then start changing American policy toward the moon, or being more aggressive about America's interest or returning to the moon? Do you think that policy, that that those assumptions that Doug put forth, would have some kind of an impact to motivate our Congress differently for a different policy or a more aggressive policy?
So who are you asking?
You. You're the guest of honor.
Okay. I think we're seeing a resurgence of a type of nationalism, and that's not always the worst thing. So this is kind of a weaselly answer. I apologize in advance, but I think it's possible. And that may be what it takes to get us off the dime and get this whole freight train moving. I don't think it's the best way. And I think it's really bad for infrastructure and possibly bad for the commercial side. But if it's forward motion, maybe that's what we're looking for. It's very unpopular to talk about expedition space exploration anymore, because most people want infrastructure, and rightfully so, and a lasting effect of all the money you're spending and the effort you're putting into it. But if the only way it's going to happen is an expeditionary nature, not closed end like Apollo, but slow growth expeditions, is that better than nothing? And I don't really know the answer to that. It's just something I'm postulating.
Rick, anything else, or do you want to clear the line?
I'll go ahead and clear the line. Thank you very much, Dr. Lewis.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Listeners, that opens up our line for others who might want to give us a call, and we should probably take a break. We're beyond the halfway point. It is 1-866-687-7223. I will say one more thing, because I'm not sure we'll come back to this topic unless another listener asks another question about it. But from an economic perspective, going to the moon and doing things on the moon costs a lot of money. And China's economy is not great. And even though they're totalitarian and their leader can wake up one day and say he wants to spend money on this and to hell with that, where we can't do that because we have Congress and we have, you know, 300 million people that are going to bitch like hell if they do that. And, you know, Congress critters want to get reelected. But in China, they can allocate resources however they want. But to go to the moon and to put up a base and to sustain it and keep it going and keep crews there and all that, even for China, that is going to cost a ton of money. And their economy is not great. They have development towns and cities in parts of China going west that are totally empty. New buildings, empty.
Right.
You know, nothing there. There's no economy to sustain all of this. I don't have any idea what the effect of a Trump administration is going to do on China, China trade, the economy, or for that matter on the U.S. either. I'm optimistic that everything is going to be okay, but I don't know that. But it could also have an adverse effect on China, just as it might have an adverse effect on the United States. I just don't know. But for China to do what Doug is talking about is going to cost them an enormous amount of money and a very big part of their resources. And yes, they are totalitarian. They can do whatever they want or what their rulers want. The question is, can they sustain it? Will they be able to do it? Can their economy keep it going? And I don't know the answer to that. Star Wars crushed the Soviet Union's economy. And that was a big reason why they ultimately fell and the wall came down. They could not outproduce, outspend what the United States was doing with Star Wars and other programs, and they took the hits for it and went down. And China may end up being in the same boat, and they may start out with a very aggressive moon plan and find out that they can't keep it up. You know, even China would have to respond to, you know, hundreds of millions of people starving and not having work and having real problems in their economy and businesses leaving and whatever else might be going on. So they're not totally sheltered from the world that they can do whatever they want. And I think all that's a wild card. So were your scenario to come true, Doug, I don't know for how long it would come true. And I just throw it out there as something to throw into a crazy mix. And, you know, who knows?
Can I add something really quick?
Yeah, sure.
I think your points are all very good and well taken. I would just add, you know, their cost of production is a fraction of ours for certain things. Some stuff just costs what it costs, but other things are much less expensive, like labor. They also, of course, have the advantage, as do Elon Musk and Bezos and a lot of other people, of the USSR and the United States having done an awful lot of heavy lifting in terms of design and experimentation in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And there's also the question of risk. You know, are they willing to accept more risk than we are? Because, as you know as well as I do, you know, when you aren't trying to work to the 3-9s level on this stuff, it can cost a lot less money if you're willing to take some losses and some risk. How sensitive they are to that, I have no idea, because I don't know much about that part of their space program. But if they are willing to take risks, I mean, they've got to, you know, their first space station is going to be joining us down here on the ground any month now. And of course that happened with Skylab, but that was a very long time ago. You're kind of hoping it doesn't happen with new space hardware, but this will be the second unplanned reentry they will have had in, what, 2 years. You know, maybe that keeps the cost a little lower, but it's certainly going to be an interesting moving target to watch.
Absolutely. And yeah, they are cheaper, and whatever it will cost them to do Doug's plan on the moon, it will cost them a hell of a lot less than it will cost the United States to do that. But yeah, it will still cost them on their terms, and you just don't know what they can endure and what they can sustain. And
right.
So with that, our guest has a couple more books that we want to talk about. He has a great book that I mentioned on the introduction. It's kind of a coffee table book, really cool, called Mars, Making Contact. And when we come back in 3 minutes, we're going to move from the moon to Mars. So everybody, don't go anyplace. We'll be back with Rod Pyle.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our space show with author Rod Pyle. We have two sponsors for this segment. Excuse me. Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. Also for this segment, AIAA is a sponsor. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They are the world's largest aerospace pro society, and they have over 30,000 individual members. 88 countries are represented, and they have about 95 corporate members. Their members are busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, increasing our knowledge of the universe, and bringing the world closer together. So check them out, AIAA.org. Come to their events. Networking is terrific, and hope to see you at some of them. I think the next big one that I will likely be attending, God willing, will be Space 2017, although it has a different name this year, and it's in Orlando, Florida, in September. Rod, before we go to Mars with you, you have a caller on the line.
All right.
Let's take your call. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hey, David. Richard Easton. How are you?
I'm fine. And you, Richard?
Good. Good.
What's up?
I got a chance to read an advanced copy of Amazing Stories, and it's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
I was flying to New Hampshire to see my family over Christmas, and it made the whole trip a lot nicer.
Good. It's a fun read, isn't it? It's very interesting.
Of course, I'm a son of a Project Vanguard veteran, so I might disagree slightly about that.
Well, that's fair.
It is a fun book. Good variety between, you know, things like the Nazi space plane and some of the close calls in the manned space program. It's just a very fun book.
Absolutely. Listeners, you can pick it up at your local bookstore or Amazon. It is a paperback, and it's 332 plus pages or something, but you can read it quickly. It's really a good read, and lots of good, interesting pictures, probably some that you've never seen before.
Yeah, I think it's actually 365. I'd have to look. But, oh, no, you're right, 332.
Well, that includes the index. It includes the index to 341 pages.
Yeah.
But why be petty on the size of something, right?
That's right.
What else, Richard?
Well, it's interesting you were talking about whether if China puts a lunar base, will politicians be suddenly saying, how could we let this happen? And I think with the early space program that happened, 1955, I believe there was a lot of talk about a bomber gap, and I believe they took some funds out of missile development and put them into bombers. And, of course, 2 years later, Sputnik happens, and Lyndon Johnson thinks that's going to launch him to the presidency the way some of the Truman Committee in the 1940s helped him be selected as VP in 44. So, the old joke, the most dangerous place in Washington is in between certain politicians and a TV camera. So I think that's a possibility. And of course, things like Project Vanguard, what was it intended to do? It was intended to launch a satellite during the International Geophysical Year. They succeeded. They were not given the objective of beating the Russians. If the U.S. had had that objective, we would have put a Navy satellite on von Braun's rocket. In fact, from what I've read, Khrushchev, Korolev had a big problem getting the Soviet generals to support him launching a satellite. They just wanted an ICBM. And it was really the reaction to Sputnik that in the West that told Khrushchev, gee, I've got a PR bonanza here. So in some ways, the Eisenhower administration was correct. You know, there never was a missile gap. But and the R-7 was not a good ICBM. It was a good platform for launching satellites and men into space, just like the Atlas, you know, launched John Glenn into space. It took too long to get it ready to be an ICBM. Of course, one ICBM dropping a bomb in your city is going to be a very bad day, but it was not a good weapon. But at any rate, we're not here to talk about the early space program. I just wanted to endorse the book, and people should go out and get it. It's a very good read, good variety, good for giving to, you know, to kids who might be interested in the space program. So well written, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that. I just want to say one thing about Vanguard. It was probably under-resourced. And if I recall properly, that rocket wasn't designed to do anything much beyond launching that satellite. So they didn't have the latitude that you would have with an ICBM program. But I think if there was an error in there, it was, all kidding aside, the televising of the TV3 launch attempt, you know, had it not been televised, had it not been live, and had it not been a spectacular failure as it was in the media, I think it would have been kind of a shrug and we move on to the next flight. So I think they got kind of a raw deal there because of that live coverage that they were saddled with.
Well, we are an open society, theoretically.
Well, yeah. One quick story about that. My dad designed the small 6-inch satellite that was on TV3 and then is the oldest satellite still up there. So when TV3 blows up, like you said, big embarrassment, but, satellite survived.
Right.
And Marty Votaw asked my dad what he should do with it, and Dad said, well, I guess take it back. So put it in its little wooden box, bought it a seat on the flight back to Washington, and it was in our house overnight, and is now at the Air and Space Museum, right next to the, at least the last time I saw it, was right next to the key that they used to launch Sputnik. So, you can see a little TV3 there today. A bit worse for wear, but it survived.
Interesting.
Yeah, the antennas are a little bent up, but it's still in pretty good shape, right?
Yes. In fact, there's a picture of Marty and my dad on the day before the 50th anniversary of Vanguard 1. They went to the Air and Space Museum. In fact, my brother, I can send David the link. There are a bunch of pictures of them with various people, including Michael Neufeld, disassembling the satellite. So if anyone is a fan of early space might find those pictures interesting.
Well, that'd be great.
If you send me the link, I'll put it in the archives of the show, or you can post it on the blog anytime. You can do that right now if you wanted to.
Sounds good. Well, at any rate, highly endorse the book, and I look forward to hearing about your other book.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Listeners, the toll-free line is now back into operation, and it is 1-866-687-7223. So I've just got my cinnamon coffee cake out to talk about this coffee table book, Mars Making Contact, and this is a Sara Lee coffee cake I'm eating, so go for it. Tell us about this coffee table book.
So this was one of those dream projects for an author where a publisher, in this case it was Carlton in the UK, came to me and said, hey, we want you to do a Mars book. Come up with a pitch and make sure it's pretty. And I said, great. And I'd worked with them a couple of times before, so this was something that, you know, we had an established relationship. So I came up with the idea of just doing a general history, and we went back and forth and kind of ground down what it was going to be. And this went on over the course of a couple of years, but it happened to coincide with the economy improving, both UK and here, because the coffee table book industry kind of died in the 2007-2008 downturn. It didn't really come back till 2013-2014. So fortunately, it was just in time for this project, so I was able to say, hey, let's have this many pictures, and let's make it big and grand and four color and just pull out the stops and make it pretty. And I thought they did a really nice job. So it's a fairly straightforward history of the exploration of Mars, which, of course, is largely an American story with a few notable exceptions. And other than writing about the amazing tales of the space age, I'm not sure you're going to have a whole lot more fun than that.
So where did you get the your pictures are fabulous.
The pictures were an interesting challenge. I had a pretty good collection by now, and boy, it's a lot easier to write a book like this in the age of the Internet than it was before when we were using card files and microfiche down at the library. JPL and NASA, of course, have wonderful collections of great high-resolution photos, and sometimes you forget how much you appreciate them until you're trying to find something from the European Space Agency or the Indian Space Agency or the Russian Space Agency, which all have different degrees of control and licensing and so forth, and you're very grateful to NASA for doing what they do. That said, there were a few that I just could not find. Like, I wanted a nice high-res picture from Viking, one of the early lander photos, with the engineering data and the color scales on it. So I got a hold of Rachel Tillman, who runs the Viking Mars Missions Education and Preservation Project and has what is in effect a whole Viking lander under her protection in a museum. She very kindly provided me with a number of documents. She has sort of the end of the Raiders of the Lost Ark garage collection or warehouse collection of documents from that program and is all about the Viking program. So she provided a bunch of material. And then individuals at JPL, of course, with ITAR clearance and so forth, allowed me to go rifle through their file cabinets. And so Rob Manning, for instance, gave me some stuff on Pathfinder that he, I'd pull it out and say, how about this? And he'd get a big grin on his face and go, oh, I haven't seen that since 1997. So between that and the JPL archives and Rachel's collection, I was able to get some really wonderful stuff, the kindness of strangers.
Rachel and Rob, of course, have been on the show, so she has a great museum up in Seattle, so it's really,
yeah,
really something. But
and no shortage of passion for the subject, I'll add.
Absolutely, but in addition to Mars pictures, which are amazing, you've got hardware pictures from not just U.S. hardware, but Russian and other hardware, so this is much more than just a coffee table book. This is pretty, this really covers a lot.
Yeah, originally I had hoped to do something like Missions to the Moon, which was a 2009 book where we actually had inclusions. So in every few pages there's an envelope and you'd pull out a fold-up map or a letter that was sent, from one FBI office to another about what are we going to do about the Von Braun problem, that kind of stuff. But unfortunately the cost of that are just so high. We said, okay, we'll just print them into the book. So you don't quite have that museum quality quote unquote reproduction, but it was a chance to really dig up some oddball stuff like that painting of the Great Galactic Ghoul. You see that here and there, but you don't usually see it in high resolution, so I was able to go to JPL and get a Kodachrome slide of that painting, which was done in the 60s. And it's interesting, you try and pin down the history of the Great Galactic Ghoul, which is this imaginary being that intercepts and eats spacecraft on their way to Mars. And it's been attributed to everyone from, the founder of JPL to Donna Shirley in 97 when it was mentioned in relation to Pathfinder's airbag retraction. And as near as I've been able to tell, it was an engineer named John Cassani in 64-65 talking about Mariner with a member of the press who just joked, well, I think we must have a Great Galactic Ghoul out there who's devouring our spacecraft en route. But whoever came up with it, it certainly has had a lasting legacy up at the lab, and it gets mentioned with nervous giggles from time to time.
And the story that goes along with everything in the pictures is also not to be dismissed, because you actually do a pretty good job in explaining what we're looking at and giving us the history of it. So it really is a history book of Mars exploration.
Yeah, and it was, again, great fun to do, and I'll never turn down, I'm working with JPL now, so I can actually come and go, but at the time, if you're media, and you want to go on to the base, quote unquote, you need to be escorted. So even if you're meeting somebody for lunch, you've got a media escort with you the whole time for understandable reasons, national security and so forth. But it was really wonderful to have a reason to go up there, escorted or not, and hang around and look at stuff and talk to these people. So I was able to get a person involved one way or another, either through an oral history or through direct contact for each of the different projects that were involved, at least on the American side, so I could put in kind of a short box with an inside story. So Rob Manning's got one, and Robert Layton has one for his involvement with Mariner 4. He was the force in actually getting a camera on Mariner 4, because at one point it was going to fly without one, which would have been kind of a bad idea. But at the time, the science people were saying, we don't need pictures of Mars. We'll just get the data we want. And he said, no, you really need... He's a professor at Caltech in physics. He said, you really need the pictures, not just for science, but for public buy-in. And, boy, was he right. And when you look at the, again, you look at the polls for support for the space program and the completely out of bounds of everything else response that people have to the images coming back from Hubble, and you understand that the visual connection is a huge thing and probably always will be, because people want to share that adventure. And I think JPL in particular has been very successful at that. NASA, by and large, has done a good job of it, especially in the last 25 to 30 years. But JPL early on figured out, especially by the time Pathfinder went up and their servers were crashed by all the interest, that this is an important part of their job and of their mission, is to communicate the beauty of the adventure to people effectively. And I think they do it very well.
And Gil Levin made your book. I see that he is discussed and Viking is discussed. So I'm glad to see that Gil got it. Did you talk to Gil at all for the book?
No, actually, a lot of that information came through Rachel and articles and oral histories. I tried to get a conversation going with him, but we couldn't put it together. But as you know, he's still of the opinion that there's a reasonably good chance that life was found by the Viking life science experiments. And of course, Norman Horowitz is no longer with us, who was the famously guy on the other side of that argument. I mean, there were a number of them, but he was probably the most contentious voice. And we're talking about the life science package on the Viking landers and the kind of weird results they got from the labeled release experiment, where after two or three other experiments in the life science package that said, it doesn't look like there's anything here, suddenly one of them starts showing an indication of what could have been microbial activity, but the rise and fall of at least the second iteration of the experiment didn't seem to match the curve they would have expected. So it looked to most of them like this was simple soil chemistry, but we still don't know.
One of the double-page pictures that I saw that I'd never seen before that I thought was really fascinating, and they say it's an artist rendition, although it looks like it could be the real thing. But if I'm understanding it, it's a 1986 rendering of a suspected Mars outpost on Phobos, which is really cool. So do you know what I'm talking about? Do you remember?
I don't have the book at hand, but I remember going through those, and you know, the wonderful thing about young people today is they grew up with computers, they grew up with digital software, they know how to do this stuff very well, and a lot of them are willing to just get it out there because they want it seen. And that one may have come from NASA, I don't remember.
Well, there's no, there's really no notation on it. It just says opposite right, a 1986 artistic rendering of a Mars outpost on Phobos, and it's page 176 and 177. But it's really a cool outpost, and Phobos looks actually very cool.
I'd go. I just don't want to be cooped up in a little can on the way there. That's biggest concern. I'm the guy that gets nervous and the elevator door takes too long to open.
Yeah.
Oh, I see the one you're talking about.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. I'd go, too, if I could get through the claustrophobia, and I want to come back. I don't want to do a one-way, and also I don't want to kick off up there. I want to kick off down here on Earth. But I'd go if you didn't have to be in a little tin can, too.
Yeah, which kind of makes the SpaceX plan a little more appealing. I mean, there's going to be an awful lot of people packed in a spacecraft that, to me, looks too small for the number they're talking about, but what the heck do I know?
Yeah, I'd be ready to kill them all by the first day of the end of the first day, probably.
Yeah, the problem is, if it's you or me, they'd probably kill us just because we feel that way.
Probably. You have another book that we wanted to talk about, which is also a lot of fun, sort of a modified coffee table book. It's not quite that. But, boy, talk about pictures and diagrams and information. Blueprint for a Battlestar, Serious Scientific Explanations Behind Sci-Fi's Greatest Inventions. How in the world did you put this thing together?
That was another UK publisher that said we'd like you to put together a book based on this idea, and it was originally going to be called How to Build a Death Star. And, of course, this was about the time that Disney acquired the Star Wars franchise, and so that conversation didn't really go in a positive direction. So I said, okay, we need to steer around that, and this is the title they came up with. And I thought it was pretty good. I'm hoping that not too many people buy it by mail order thinking that it's going to be about Battlestar Galactica. I did work on that show briefly, so I've got some street cred, but this book has virtually nothing to do with Battlestar Galactica. So the original idea sort of started with, okay, can you build the Death Star? How would you do it? How much would it cost? Those kind of questions. And just expanded to, let's pick 25 chapters of various technologies of the future that we have some grasp on today and talk about how we got where we are and what's around the corner in a realistic time frame, 10 to 20 years. So something like teleportation didn't make the cut because it's just too far off and we don't know enough about it. But if you're talking about flying cars and jetpacks and faster than light travel, that was a bit of a stretch, but robotics, AI, things like that, that's really where it started. And I think the sample chapter I turned in was called Attack of the Fembots, so that gives you an idea of how tongue-in-cheek the first draft was. It got toned down a bit after that.
That was the subject of a lot of shows on the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman. They had to deal with fembots all the time. This is strictly Rod Pyle. I mean, I don't know any other author that would do this. You've got on page 8, Weapons of the Future. Boy, that is Rod Pyle through and through. Death from
That's
above.
That's a good thing, right?
I guess. Death from above, building a death planet. The ultimate weapon, making a death ray. Shields up, creating a force field. Swords of heat, using light swords. Judgment Day, the rise of AI. Stun, kill, or disintegrate. Ray guns and rocket rifles. And you give the plans for this stuff. I mean, how cool is this to give your macho guy as a birthday gift or something? I mean, this is really a great book. I mean, I'm having more fun with this one than the other two. I mean, this is really a fun book, Rod.
I'm glad to hear it. I had a kind of a surprise. If you're an author, you get to sign into a thing called Author Central at Amazon, and you can see the data on your books. It's only what they're selling, and it's only print, so you're missing what's going to bookstores, and you're missing what's going on Kindle and so forth, although this isn't available as an ebook, but it doesn't count for what's happening in the broader market. But just on Amazon, this book took off in early January. I have no idea why. It might have had something to do with a radio appearance or something. I can't correlate it with anything, but it sold over the course of a week, like, I don't know, 1,200 copies or something like that, which was breathtaking, because although that doesn't sound like a big number in our business, it's a pretty big number for a short period of time. So it was a lot of fun to do. It made me very happy. My wonderful editor had the foresight to tone down my writing a bit, because as you can probably tell, there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek in there, and I probably had but another 25% of a snark factor, but she was smart enough to say, okay, you got to reel this in, because that's not going to play in all our markets. And I said, ah, okay.
So, Doug, this is for you. Guess where the book was manufactured. Now, I don't really see manufactured for a book. I usually see printed or distributed. But this says manufactured. So, Doug, it's made in China. So I don't know if
that's a shocker.
I don't know if this has any significance to your assumptions about China and going to the moon. but maybe this is where they're getting their information. I don't know. But did you have to go through ITAR with your designs to have this thing done in China?
No, because it was all publicly accessible, and I didn't have any special access for any of this. And I'll say one thing. For years, books, picture books like these have been printed overseas because it's been cheaper, easily for 25 years. The problem used to be, if you were going to be printing in China, the Philippines, or Vietnam, or somewhere, you had to go over there and ride roughshod over the project to make sure that it didn't get upside down pages and bad color blends and that kind of stuff, because there were just a lot of errors. Those days are long gone, and their print and assembly work is absolutely top rate. So while it would be wonderful on some levels to be able to do it here, I'm grateful that Asia is able to turn out the quality of work they do, because it lets books get written that wouldn't otherwise be done.
So you have another incredible picture that I want to bring to listeners' attention. It's a double-page picture, 150 to 151, Blue Mars, which is just gorgeous. Where did you pick up this picture?
I think I may have bought that one from, what's the name of that website? Because I went through a number of stock providers, of course, as we always do. And there are places like Getty that charge retail, so you're looking at $1,000 for one photograph. And then there are microstock companies, they call them, that sometimes have some good work, although it's very touch and go whether you're going to find something you like. And they might charge $50. But I think that one came from one of the alternative art sites on the web.
It's by, a really cool picture.
Yeah, an original piece of art. And that's another thing. Like I said, young people have gotten so good at rendering and creating stuff now that there's just this plethora of great artwork out there.
Well, this book has it in there. And listeners, you don't have a copy in front of you, but in a way, and this probably predates many of you too, it's, you're looking at pictures and they look like they're blueprints. So those of you that are younger, millennials, you probably don't know what a blueprint is, I guess, because they don't do them anymore. But did you do that on purpose to make them look like blueprints, given that this was, well, of course, that's your title, but you've made all the pictures, or many of them, look like you're looking at blueprints for drawings for a building or a structure or something.
Yeah, I think that was the conceit sort of from the beginning, is a lot of this is, all this in one way or another, is future technology derived, at least the big chunk of the chapter. So let's go ahead and make it feel as real as possible. So the idea was to go ahead and do them as blueprints. We struggled a bit over, do we do a traditional blueprint? Do we have it a little faded and beat up looking, or do we do what we finally ended up with, which basically looks like a chalk rendering on a grid? And I think they did a great job.
No, they did.
Illustrated in the UK.
And it's a really good effect. I mean, very creative, very unusual. And it's an eye-catcher, and I'm sure this book will continue to do well for you for a long, long time to come. It really is outstanding.
Well, I hope so. I really appreciate that. Thanks.
So what's next for Rod Pyle? You have a book called Space 2.0 or something like that?
Yeah, that's one we talked about before. I'm working on that, and that's New Space and national space agencies in the international scene, and private and commercial, and really just taking a look at what's happening in the next 20 years, what are the benefits, what are the challenges, who's thinking of doing what. And I had been pushing this book one way or the other for probably five to six years at one point. A couple of publishers said, well, if you can kind of mix near term with Interstellar, we'll think about it. And I thought, I don't think those two really want to live in the same book. And then finally the NSS stepped up and said, look, we'll help get this published. And I said, great. So I went out and found a wonderful publisher, Ben Bella, and that's going to come out in the first couple of months of 2018.
That's the one you interviewed me with, right?
That's right. And I appreciate it, because you're going to be in there a lot.
Well, I hope that you did my interview justice, and that I didn't make a fool of myself.
All I can do is use the words you said, David.
Well, that's why I'm making these comments ahead of time.
Yeah, no, it was a good and very helpful interview, and I also was able to go to the NSS and a couple other groups put together a space settlement conference in Santa Monica a couple of weeks ago. and was able to attend that, and there was a lot of good material there. And it was nice because it was a smaller group and it was single track. We didn't have to make choices about which talk we were going to go to. We all went from one to the next and the next.
I didn't really get a chance to ask you much, but did you enjoy the film festival?
I did. I didn't get to stay for the last film, and I missed the first one. But I thought, you know, I think this is their first one, right?
No, I think it's the third one.
Third one, okay. I thought, you know, given the resources they've got and what they're trying to do, I thought it was really put together very well. It was kind of charming. I loved, what was it called, Passenger 25?
Is that the one where the British girl won the lottery to?
Yeah, she wins the last seat on, you know, we don't know it's Elon Musk. Gossip seems an awful lot like a combination of Elon Musk and
right.
Mars One. And she wins that last seat on Mars. Very little of it takes place on Mars. Most of it's about what happens.
Well, she's a working-class woman in the U.K., and what happens to her when she wins the prize because she's got all these other problems in her life just surviving.
Like the rest of us. And they did. I mean, that was a tiny budget. I was asked not to say the number, but I interviewed the director and the actress, and it's less than a lot of people would spend on a new car. So for the amount they spent on this thing that looked feature quality for the most part, I thought it was just a sensationally well-done piece. And then a number of them were. That was just the one that really caught my attention.
Yeah, listeners, you can see it on Raw Science TV's website. You may have to become a paid member or something to see it. I'm not sure. But it was long. It was about 30 minutes, right, or 40 minutes. But it's very unusual.
It's feature length, actually. I think it was maybe 70 minutes.
It was long, but it is really unusual. And all I can say is very creative, and I think they did an excellent job with it. I agree with you. I guess I could go to Kerry and find out how to contact them and interview them. They're in the U.K., right? I think they live in the U.K.
Oh, the director, producer, yeah, they're both from the U.K.
And the actress didn't have any background or anything with space, as I understand it, right? She was just an actress, sort of wanting to be actress, right?
Yeah, I mean, she's a serious actress. She studied at a British Academy, and she had done other work. But this is really her first crack at being a star in a feature-length project, and the director hadn't done a whole lot. So for people that were kind of early out of the box, I thought, man, you know, I mean, I used to do some of that, and there's a good reason that you're not looking at any of the movies I made right now, because they weren't very good. And I thought their work was sensational. They do have the advantage that now technology kind of gets out of your way, and this stuff's a lot easier to do, but I still thought it was a sensational job.
But I enjoyed it, and some of the people I met have been guests on the space show already. Dr. Lubin of Breakthrough Starshot was on yesterday, and I would go again, and I've recommended Raw Science to the show many, many times over, and we'll continue to do that. Carrie's doing a great job.
Yeah, and she's very mission-driven, which you have to love. I mean, she's really... she's got this incredible background of having been a solo ballerina in Oklahoma Ballet, I think.
She
was a jockey for a while, and then she worked in biotech devices and ended up doing this. And, I mean, it's taken me this long to get decent at writing books. I don't know how she's done all this at her younger age, but she's a very accomplished woman. And to take on this STEM-focused project, I thought was really impressive.
Absolutely. Rod, we're coming up toward 2 hours, so any concluding comments, anything we should have talked about that we've forgotten to or that you wanted to make sure we talked about? This is your last chance for a Hail Mary here.
My Hail Mary is, if you enjoy any of the books, please leave reviews on Amazon and or Goodreads, because they're much harder to get than you'd think. I was whining about this to somebody the other day, and they said, how many reviews did you leave last year? Because I read about 50 books a year. And I said, well, guilty as charged.
I don't,
so it's not something that we naturally break down and do, but they're very helpful.
I don't. I try to read all of the books that I do for guests, and I hardly ever do a review on Amazon. First of all, it's a pain in the ass to do.
Yeah, it is.
And I don't remember, or I don't take the time. Now, if somebody goes out of their way and really asks me to do it, I will go ahead and do it. But other than that, I don't typically do it. And I guess you're right. We should do it, and we should help the authors with these great space books. And maybe the reviews do help. I don't know if they do or not.
Well, let me just comment on that real quickly, which is because you're going to get into the book writing trade along with the rest of us poor souls. You live and die by these things, and at this point in the publishing industry, in terms of print anyway, you're very lucky if you clear 5,000 or 6,000 books on your first run, maybe for the life of the book. Some books do better at 10,000 to 20,000. Of course, there are some like The Martian that, you know, go up in the hundreds of thousands and millions. But for the most part, they're counting on break even at somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000. And it's a struggle to get there. And the nice thing about Amazon reviews is the more reviews it gets, the more stars it gets, the more frequently it pops up on suggestions and, you know, all those complex algorithms they got. And the more of that that happens, the more we're able to keep writing these things, because it's not an industry that pays particularly well, especially for newer authors. And they need your support, or they're not going to be able to do it anymore, and it's just going to be us old retired guys and folks that are independently wealthy. So if you want regular working-class authors to be able to keep doing the wonderful work they do, it's going to require that level of support. And, you know, it only needs to be a sentence or two. It doesn't need to be one of these ambitious two-page reviews that some people do, although I appreciate those too. A couple of lines and just your honest impressions of what you've read. And Goodreads is a wonderful resource as well. It's a little more, got a little more of a leather armchairs in the club kind of feeling to it. Amazon's a little cool on that side, but they both serve their purposes, and it does help let people know what they're getting into. So if it's the kind of book they want, they'll probably learn more from your review than they're going to learn from whatever the publisher puts on there.
All right.
It's not market driven.
When I archive the show, I'll give you reviews on all three books.
Well, and in exchange, I'll give you a couple of excellent editors for your book.
Well, thank you. I'm just at the preliminary stage of, do I really want to do this? So I would appreciate
it. We want you to do it.
Give me a ghostwriter, too, and go that route. Get somebody else to do all the work. You know, there's nearly 3,000 shows, so how in the hell do you even remember what they are? So, I mean, it is a big undertaking to summarize 3,000 shows in 16 and a half years on the space show.
Yeah, that's going to be a big challenge.
Yeah, so maybe I need an author partner to do it with me or something. We'll see. But, yeah, I will. And I'll when I archive the show, I'll let you know about the reviews as well.
Sensational.
Let me know when Space 2.0 comes out or something else that would want to have you back on the show. And I look forward to it.
I do, too, and thanks very much. I had a really great time. It was good talking to you and all your callers.
Okay, and stay well, and hope to see you at another conference or event in the very near future, and we will stay in touch. And listeners, that's it for tonight, so I do want to thank everybody who called in and who have sent in emails, and we appreciate that, and certainly want to thank Rod for being with us and for the great work that he has done, and all of you. So have a great rest of the evening, have a terrific week, and keep looking up as ordered by the space show. Good night, everybody.